does with our panel. But first, I'd like to begin today's session by acknowledging and honoring the land that I'm on, which has been the site of human activity since time immemorial. It's the traditional territories of many nations, including the Mississaugas of the Credit, the Anishinaabeg, the Chippewa, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat's peoples. The land is now home to many Indigenous nations from across Turtle Island, including the Inuit and Métis. These nations and this land are subject to the Dish With One Spoon Wampum Belt Covenant, an agreement to peaceably share and care for the land and its resources. We are all treaty people. Many of us have come as settlers, immigrants, newcomers in this generation or generations past. And recognizing that we are treaty people, it is our duty to respect the laws of this land and to uphold our treaty obligations. That is the truth and truth and reconciliation. I am mindful of broken covenants and strive to make this right with the land and with each other. When we talk about our food system here in Canada, thinking critically about the relationship we have with the land within the context of the seasonal agricultural worker program, the destruction of this relationship lies at the root of these issues that we are here to talk about today. I'd like everyone to take a moment to reflect on this, on how stolen land and labor, the forced displacement of communities, the erasure of traditional food systems, and the exploitation of natural resources through capitalism are the cornerstones of Canada's food system. So today we're going to have a panel discussion with some incredible guests from all across the country. So that's going to be from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Then we're going to switch over to our digital day of action. For the DDA, you'll be split into breakout rooms. Be patient for this process as facilitators will guide you through the actions, but also you'll be divided into breakout rooms and that takes time. Then we're going to come back into the lobby for the last 5 minutes to do a quick wrap up. So some other housekeeping. Currently everyone's muted, but we'll of course unmute as we start. We are currently live streaming and recording to Facebook, so feel free to keep your cameras off for the panel as it is being recorded, and feel free to keep yourself muted. You can definitely use the chat to fill in any questions. That also includes people watching the Facebook live stream. You can take your questions there and we'll also answer them here. And also, feel free to update your names or pronouns using the meeting settings. Okay, so I'm gonna introduce our moderator. He has an incredibly short bio, so I hope he can build on it because I know he's done so many incredible things. But Gabriel is a powerhouse organizer with Justice for Migrant Workers and is also a former migrant worker himself. You may recognize him as he's always running around doing so much work for the organization. Gabriel, you can just take it away and introduce our guests.
Sorry, you are muted.
Perfect. Yeah, thank you so much for all the hard work and for the warm introduction. Thanks for all the effort you put into such a great event on such a great day. Extra special greetings to each and everyone in Zoom land tonight. Today is the 18th of December. On the 16th of October, which is roughly 2 months ago, it was World Food Day. Was it September? We observed Thanksgiving. And pretty soon will be Christmas when we share the best meal with the people we love the most. But during this year, because of COVID, we've been encouraged to stay home. And I'm pretty sure during that time, we tend to think more about our food. How secure, how food secure are we? And during this year, we also get to appreciate the role that migrant workers play in putting food on our table, in ensuring our food security. Tonight, I have a very difficult job. They give us 1 hour to talk. 1 hour. And at the same time, I have to take you across the country because I have people across the country. So in 1 hour, are you ready to travel across the country in 1 hour? But also during that 1 hour, I want to give you 1 million reasons why I want you to take action in the second hour. Are you ready for that? But to give you 1 million reasons, I have some incredible people and they're scattered across the country. I would like to introduce those four people. The first person who is on the West Coast is Dr. Evelyn Encalada Gregg. She's an assistant professor in labor studies at Simon Fraser University, and she's a founding member and organizer with our collective, Justice for Migrant Workers, or Justicia. She recently relocated out on the West Coast. So she's on the West Coast and she'll be sharing with us her experiences. Our other panelist would be Asaf Rashid. And he has been a contributor over the years to the fight for justice for migrant workers, refugees, and others in Canada struggling for status. He's a lawyer, currently on leave from practice, but preparing to restart in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He's also an organizer with the Halifax Workers Action Center, which assists precarious workers in their fights for workplace justice. I also have the pleasure of introducing a colleague of mine. We've been in the battle for a while, Carlos Burrell. He's from Jamaica. He's a former migrant farm worker. He's an activist. And I'm pretty sure if you're familiar with the documentary, Migrant Dreams by Min Suk Lee, you would see him featured in that. Some great success stories with Carlos, in addition to being featured in that documentary. He won his lawsuit against his former employer. And another victory under his belt is that he recently won a really tough battle for humanitarian and compassionate application. That is a great title to win after going through so much tough time at work. The fourth panelist I would like to introduce is another Carlos Sandoval. He's from Mexico. He's currently coordinating for migrant worker support program at Progressive Intellectual Community Services. He has a master's in political science by the National Autonomous University of Mexico, and a BA in sociology and anthropology by Simon Fraser University. And he has extensive experience working with social movements and marginalized communities in Mexico. So I would like you to join me in welcoming this panelist. And I would like to start off the event, this activity tonight, by asking a simple question. I am not too sure in what order I should start, but I will ask Dr. Evelyn to start it off. Please tell us, can you tell us a little about yourself, where you're located right now, and how you became engaged in organizing for migrant workers' rights? Thank you.
Okay, let's get this started. Thank you so much to our amazing social media team at Justicia. I'm always blown away by all of your talents, and I love what you are all doing with Harvesting Freedom Instagram account. I'm really thrilled to be with you, all of you here. Special hello to Perry Sorio from Migrante BC. He's also part of the East Coast, West Coast Exodus. So here we are now through this forum online. Well, my name is Evelyn Encaladagres, and I've been working with and walking with the migrant community for about 20 years now. This person that maybe some of you know, Chris Ramsrup, he asked me several years ago if I could be an interpreter to go to this place called Leamington, Ontario. At that time, I had no idea where that was, what that was. And it was all for basically an investigative mission to uncover what had happened with around 20 migrant farm workers from Mexico who were deported, repatriated to Mexico for organizing a wildcat strike. And so I sort of knew that that migrant workers came here to Canada, but I thought, oh, they're fine. And I was just worried about just going back to Latin America, forget about Canada, and just didn't want anything with Canada. I just was, you know, always quite seduced by the ideas of revolution in Latin America. But then I went to Leamington that particular weekend, and it completely changed many of our lives. We went to Leamington with just a few of us. Chris organized that first trip. But, you know, taking that trip, it was almost like we were going to another world. It was 4 hours, but you know, the more we drove out of Toronto, the more that all of Canada changed. The more that that space that we reached in rural Ontario was more of the white colonial Canada that that was intended as such when Europeans colonized much of this territory. And so we were all bodies out of place in Leamington. And well, to make a long story short, because I want to be mindful of the time, that weekend we reached out to all of these migrant workers that told us about all of their situation, the way that they were treated. And I nearly, because I had to interpret for everybody, and mostly all the workers said, Señorita, they treat us like animals. Señorita, they treat dogs better than they treat us. And after that weekend, almost like all of us, we developed a radical form of consciousness about ourselves again. Or, you know, we were walking, well, I was walking around with this cognitive dissonance about, you know, just wanting to get out of here and forgetting my own family's immigrant working class experiences. And with the migrant workers, I realized that, you know, there was so much work to be that we had to do here in Canada, and that I couldn't leave, and that I had to be true to the struggle and what we had started in Leamington. We built all of this momentum. That's when we started inviting more people to come out with us. That's when we invited also Min Suk Lee, who then went on to make El Contrato, the first documentary about migrant farm workers, and then Migrant Dreams. And then that's how a whole movement started. But we didn't start the movement. It was those migrant workers that organized a wildcat strike. They started the movement. We just responded and started sharing knowledge, community knowledge, and we've been building since there. So I will leave it at that. And that's how we formed Justicia. And I look forward to talking about how this year, this season has been the most difficult season ever for migrant workers.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thanks for laying the foundation, that the platform that allows me, Carlos, and other workers to, you know, to continue the fight and the struggle. At this point, can I put Carlos, in 2 minutes, can you tell us a little about yourself, where you're located, and how you became engaged in that work? Carlos? Well, there are two Carlos. I would say Carlos Burrell.
Yeah, good evening, everyone. I'm presently in Brampton. Yay, Brampton. And I was at Leamington Great Lakes, right? And I was working as a migrant worker. And I became involved because I was a victim of injustice. And because of that, it made me more aware of, you know, people around me that's being hurt, people around me that their rights are being trampled on and violated. And it, you know, it sparked something in me. And, you know, from then I met up with the Justicia group, where I met Chris, and we went to several meetings, and I met Gabriel there at the first meeting. And, you know, it was, it just took off. Skyrocketed from there, and here we are today, still fighting.
Thank you so much for joining the fight, Carlos. I know your fight is not an easy fight, and so too was mine. I'll say a little about mine. But before I do that, can I ask the other Carlos to, in 2 minutes, to tell us where you're located, a little about yourself, and how you became engaged, involved in those struggles. Is Mr. Carlos Sandoval connected? Is he on mute?
Carlos, you're unmuted, but your voice isn't coming through for some reason. Mm. It might be your microphone.
Yeah, we can't hear him. What should I do? Should I move on to the next speaker whilst we try to?
That sounds good. He nodded. So yeah, we'll do that. Thank you, Gabriel.
Okay, great. Mr. Asaf Rashid, in 2 minutes, can you tell us where you're located, a little about yourself, and how you became involved in that struggle?
Oh, absolutely. Okay, so my name is Asif Rashid. I live in Chibuktuk, also known as Halifax. It's unceded Mi'kmaq territory. And I guess where it all started for me was back in 2005. I participated in a Status for All march from Montreal to Ottawa. And we met a lot of great folks there, including a number of migrants, a number of people who are fighting for refugee status in Canada, to stay in Canada. And from there, it just continued. I was involved with No One is Illegal Fredericton for a few years before I recently moved back to Halifax. I was also in Toronto recently, and I was very briefly involved with No One is Illegal there. So I try to just throw myself in wherever I am. And along the way, I've also interviewed Chris Ramsarup a number of times on community radio for different stations I've been involved in about all the struggles of migrant workers and the victories too. So currently I'm a member of a new group. It's called the Migrant Worker Rights Working Group based in Chibuktuk, which I'll get into more in just a second, which is right now. So in like 45 seconds, I'll just let you know about this group. So basically we formed, it's just a working group. It's myself from the Halifax Workers Action Center and my collaborator, Stacy from No One's Illegal Chibuktuk Halifax, Wanda from the Global African Congress in Nova Scotia chapter, and Jessica from the Halifax Religious Society of Friends, which is the Quakers. So it's a group of folks all interested in helping advance rights and justice for migrant workers. Not a formal organization at this point, not yet at least. We basically formed just this past July at the time where there was a crisis hitting, of course, across the country with migrant farm workers getting COVID-19 during the pandemic. And here in where we're at, we were trying to push demands that migrant workers had for justice, for safety, and for workplace rights. So we basically bouncing off the report from Migrant Workers Alliance for Change, unheeded warnings. We were pushing certain demands in Nova Scotia, pushing the province to do something about labor standards here, housing standards, all these issues that migrant workers have been bringing up for years. We had a letter with 17 demands in it, signed by 36 organizations, unions, social justice groups, faith-based organizations, and others. And of course, we were ignored by the government, who just didn't even respond to us. We pushed again, showed up at the office of the Minister of Labor during COVID, so we had to do it in small numbers. But we got a non-response there, where the government's claiming everything's fine. So I'll get into more than that later. But basically, I really wanted to give an introduction to this new group that is hopefully going to take a lot more action where we're at over here. And we also screened El Contrato back in November. I just heard Evelyn mention that. So that's me.
Thank you for such a comprehensive introduction. At this time, I'm not too sure whether Carlos is ready to go. Are you all sorted out?
No, we still can't hear you, Carlos. Do you want to try rejoining?
Okay, thank you. Okay. So in the meantime, can I say a little about myself? My name is Gabriel. As you heard, I'm from St. Lucia. I'm a former migrant farm worker. I wanted to be a tourist in Canada, but who is a migrant? A migrant is people who are forced to leave their home country. And the three simple things, but powerful things that forced me to come to Canada: environmental destruction. Because of a hurricane, I was forced to come to Canada. What are countries causing and contributing to global warming and climate change? What are the ones paying the price? I'm forced to be in Canada because of a hurricane. I'm forced to be in Canada because of WTO, the World Trade Organization. What are the countries? This is one of so many global international institutions that are just there to keep the great divide between those who have and those who don't have. I'm forced to come to Canada because of GI, global inequality. Don't we have sufficient resources for everybody? But do we have sufficient resources for the top 1%? That's the problem. And because I was forced to come to Canada, look at that. In my home country, depending on where I am a god. Depending on where I am an angel. Depending on where I'm a slave. Depending on where I'm a half human. Depending on where I'm a lab rat. And that is what my story is about. So I am, Elizabeth, would you be kind enough to let me know when Carlos is, the other Carlos is sorted out? As we move on, I want to draw your attention to something which is important. The program that brought me, the program that brought Carlos Burrell, the program that brings migrant workers to Canada is like a telephone number. The program that brings us to Canada is like a tree. And I want to tell you simply that that tree, that program that brought us to Canada, this year it's 54 years old. It started in 1966 in Jamaica. The program, the three simple parts of that tree, the three pillars of that program are: one, the stem, the branches, the leaves. We are in Canada. The migrant workers, migrant farm workers are in Canada because of the stem of that tree. We are here to do jobs Canadians don't want to do. And this year, I call it the best year in a way, in inverted commas, because this year unemployment, I'm pretty sure it's at its highest in Canada. That's the year Canadians should prove that they do not need migrant workers. That's the year that Canadians should be willing and you know, accept those jobs freely. But yet still, migrant workers are deemed essential, but not treated fairly. What are the branches? We are here to do those dirty jobs, but what are the branches in that pillar? What's the second pillar? We cannot apply for status. Over 100 years, Canada continued to use unjust immigration laws and unjust labor laws. These two things work in tandem to keep migrant workers vulnerable and precarious. From the Chinese railroad workers, Canada continued to use unjust immigration, unjust labor laws. And what are the leaves? The third pillar of that program, we are tied to our employer by way of a tied work permit. To be tied to an employer, to do the dirty work and not having status. And what is status? Status is a two-edged sword. If we have status, it takes care of our immigration vulnerabilities. If we have status, it also takes care of our labor vulnerabilities. And Canada continues to use those two things. As a result of that, as a result of we not having status, we face 20 injustices. So my next question to my guests would be, let me start with Asav. Can you tell us what are the issues that you come across in your area when it comes to workers on the seasonal agriculture workers program or migrant farm workers generally?
Sure, yeah, let me get into that. So basically, it's a lot of the same issues, but there are some particular examples that have been brought up over the years here. There's a revelation of a number of complaints that were made by migrant farm workers in the seasonal agriculture worker program over a course of 2009 to 2018, which included, these are things that everyone here has heard before, that happened in Nova Scotia as well, working without pay. In one case, there was a snake infested bunkhouse. Another case, not allowed to go to the washroom. Another case, 36 workers who were not provided with accommodation from the farmer and then put up in an abandoned church with no washroom. In 2016 to 2018, other migrant workers in a bunkhouse with no running water and had to go to the river to get water. And that was just what the farmer provided. Another case, employer providing housing with no windows, and it goes on and on. So there's been a number of these kinds of issues. And of course, still migrant workers in Nova Scotia don't have access to provincial health coverage. They have to go with private insurance. And overall, one of the things that's really interesting about Nova Scotia, to put a bit of historical context, is between 2006 and 2010, the number of migrant farm workers tripled in Nova Scotia. It was approximately 300, just over 300, and it went up to about 900. So a tripling of the seasonal agriculture worker program in the province. But meanwhile, at the same time, the rest of the country went up by about 16%. So suddenly you had this huge surge. But what was going on at that time, you didn't see the organizations on the ground. Like, there wasn't a Justicia on the ground or other organizations dedicated to providing support and helping migrant workers fight for rights and justice in the workplace. So that was what was missing. And all the way to today, I think it's been a struggle to have that infrastructure on the ground so that migrant workers have individuals, people, organizations that are there to fight with them. Because obviously the system is not accessible. And that's been another big challenge. When is a migrant worker supposed to call to make a complaint when they're working all day, even into the evening on the weekends? The line is not open when a migrant farm worker actually may have time in the evening. Also, what about service in their language? That's also a problem. Pick up the phone and call labor standards, which is what it would be in Nova Scotia, and have somebody who isn't even speaking in the language you want to speak to them in. And then there's another access issue. So what's the point of a complaint system when here you have the labor minister saying, oh, everything's in place in the system, it's accessible. Workers can complain, migrant workers can complain just like anyone else. But the system isn't set up that way because the labor minister and the rest of the government don't listen to migrant workers. They don't even pay attention to these issues, even when it's brought in right to their face. So all kinds of issues like this. There's also a worker recently who a couple of members of our group helped out who was injured and needed assistance accessing workers' compensation. Entitled to it, but the employer wasn't helping out at all. ACHU was trying to deny this worker the workers' compensation. So a couple of members of our group managed to meet this worker and assist this worker in getting access to what he was entitled to. There's also another issue that that arose. This isn't specifically COVID related, but it kind of brings up the whole injustice that as you were just talking about, Gabriel, which is that there's a worker who's been coming back for many years here in Nova Scotia. This past summer, his family home in his home country just burned down. But here's the thing, coming back for year after year in Canada doesn't have the money to cover the cost of a burned down home. Of course not, because the wages just aren't what migrant farm workers deserve, which is much more. Of course, permanent residency is also what should be there. So there's a fundraiser actually going on, and I think I'm going to share the link in the chat over a way folks that are interested can support this family. I'll just put the link up right now, and I guess I'll just leave with that. There's so much to talk about, but I'll let the next person go.
Thank you so much. At this point, Carlos?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yeah, better, way better. Thank you.
Yeah, no, sorry about that. I'll try to be quick. There was some issue with my computer. I had to change the computers. My name is Carlos Sandoval. I am in British Columbia, and I am coordinating the Migrant Support Workers program here in Progressive Intercultural Community Services. This is a non-governmental organization here in British Columbia, and I recently moved back from Mexico. For many years, I have been actually working in Mexico with indigenous communities and other marginalized communities. And for me, that was very important because we can actually see the other face of immigration that is often invisible from the perspective when one is here in Canada, which is why do the migrant workers have to leave their country and come here to Canada. I actually had the opportunity to visit many communities in Mexico and talk to some of the workers from there. And there's problems, you know, of economic marginalization, there's problems of violence, there's political and social conflicts, which actually make it a necessity for workers to come here to Canada. And I think it's important that when we think about our food that's in our tables, we actually have to think about the lives, like the whole lives of the people behind those industries that make it possible for our food to come into our table. And I'll just be very brief about some of the issues that I have seen here in Canada, in British Columbia. Now I am here looking at it from this perspective. And it's appalling to see how, like, when the workers are coming from injustices in Mexico, they come here, and oftentimes what they're encountering here in Canada is another form of injustice. And injustices, serious injustices. And one of the main issues that I've seen here is it evolves around the issue of freedom. Like the previous speaker was saying, there's a lot of things coming up, like harassment in the labor places, health issues, mobility issues. But all of them, I think that what they have in common is the issue of lack of freedom. For example, what I've seen here is that the employers sometimes there's a harassment against the workers, but the workers will be afraid to actually say something because there is the threat that they can be sent back to their country. And the government of Canada has all of these legal issues in place. For example, I'm thinking about the open work permit for vulnerable workers and other things that are supposedly services available to the workers, but they're not using them because they're not thought in the perspective of the workers. The workers are not free to use these tools because of the way that the program is structured. And for example, many of them have told me that they would like to apply for a vulnerable open work permit for vulnerable workers, but they're not going to do it because that's only going to be valid for 1 year, and then after that year they might not be hired by another employment, and it's the onus is put on themselves to find an employer. And or for example, health issues. A couple of workers that I talked to, they were having serious health problems, and they supposedly are covered by the insurance, medical insurance. But again, because the employer will get upset if they're constantly asking the employer to be taken to the clinic, they feel that the employer will get upset, and that's why they will not make use of these services. Or the issue of mobility, apparently we're talking about supposedly free workers, but what's happening is that they're not free at all. I remember this one case in which the employer had a disagreement with the worker, and the employer decided that they were not going to take the employer to the airport, and it was the day that they had to actually go back to Mexico. And they said, well, you're free. You're saying you're free. Okay, go and get yourself to the airport. But, they were in an isolated area, didn't know about the transportation, didn't speak the language. And so they become very vulnerable. And I think that's one of the main issues that I've seen here. It has to do with the issue of freedom. I don't want to take too much space because there are other great speakers.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think you made up for all that time, all the trouble the computer gave you. I'll just pick up on one issue. In a meeting with some government officials, they said, and they gave me 100 cards of a government hotline. And I think it's a hotline. They said from the time they've had that hotline, not one call. They've never received one call. And it's true. It's a hotline. That's so hot. Why is it so hot? Why people don't use it? Because they're it is a complaints-driven hotline. They expect the workers to complain. Whereas the whole program makes you vulnerable. The threat of deportation is a real thing. Will you ever want to use a hotline and with the fear that knowing that it can be traced back to you? And the government is not ashamed to talk about that. Their avenues but again, as you said, and we all know, the program is an employer-driven program. It is bent towards the employer and not in favor of the worker. And there's fear. That program has fear written all over it. There's fear written and built into that program. But that is what this session is about tonight. Is it living a life of fear or living a life of hope? And that is why we need action. Dr. Evelyn, you've been a founding member. Can you tell us, the struggles that you've seen from workers? You spoke about the wildcard strike, and I'm pretty sure over your 2 decades in justicia and your work, and especially working with the 5%, roughly 5% of the ladies who won the seasonal agricultural workers program, you've seen a lot of things. Can you enlighten us?
Yes, well, I kept on thinking about how our organizing has had to we've undertaken our organizing through the veil, the very thick veil or fog of fear. So for instance, I could recall so many moments where I had to strategize with migrant workers, particularly women, to meet them at a secret place in a rural town so I can take them to a clinic. And I remember once I picked up one compañera from Mexico, and it was raining. And by the time that she met me, she was all soaked because she left the farm in a haste without an umbrella. And those stories repeat themselves. If this was 20 years ago, this is throughout 20 years, and I still hear the same stories being repeated across Canada, and the reason why I was taking the workers to the hospital, to the doctors, because that way they could keep what is happening with their bodies private, because when they come to Canada, they're basically, all aspects of their lives are controlled by employers. And many times these programs, the SOP and the more sort of recent, the agricultural stream of the NOC-CNZ program that started in 2002, and that's like a program that employers could turn to hire for 2 years. And of course, they don't hire recent university graduates from Europe. They hire people who are already at a global disadvantage because of all of the, you know, reasons that you were mentioning, Gabriel, environmental destruction, and of course, economic restructuring. Canada, you know, has long signed a trade deal within this continent that has devastated rural economies in Mexico primarily. Now they, you know, they fortified that agreement. It's called, you know, a different name now, but it's all about capital and extraction and displacement of people and dispossession of people from their own livelihoods. So these programs instead, what they do is they favor agricultural production and capital accumulation more so than migrant workers and their families. So that's the main problem. And from there, there's all of those branches that we can speak of, the branches of unfreedom. And, you know, why is it that migrant workers are so essential, but then their skills are considered low skill? And that's one of the main reasons that the government keeps on telling us that they don't have a pathway to citizenship, to permanent residency, because they're low skill. But who among us, PhDs, BAs, MAs, whatever, do we have the skill to produce food? No, that is a skill, and none of this is recognized. And so, you know, Canada was supposed to eliminate race-based immigration considerations since 1967, but in 1966, they created this program with the start of Jamaica and then expanded it, and then continued on with racist and classist and sexist immigration policies and enmeshed them all in the temporary foreign worker programs. So, you know, people that look like us are being used to build the nation and not be a part of the nation, and they are completely disposable, and that's what's wrong. And I've also had a chance to work with a lot of workers back in their home communities. And so it's really important for us to also think about the children that are left behind. They want to know why their parents have to be away from them for so long. And why Canada, a country that's supposed to be so benevolent and respectful of human rights, why doesn't Canada want them? You know, and so we need to demystify the myth of Canada and continue to hold Canada accountable. And one of the main demands that we started making after our first season organizing in Leamington, after our first spring and summer, meeting so many workers, you know, we realized early on that the only way was for status, you know, permanent residency, for that to be enacted. So that way no worker could be disposable. Of course, we know racialized workers still require support of all sorts, like many racialized Canadians that who are here with permanent residency. But at least, you know, we would support migrant workers in that way, so that way they wouldn't be disposable and be thrown away like yesterday's newspaper.
Thank you so much. Mr. Carlos Birrell, as a former migrant farm worker, I'm pretty sure you face several injustices in 2 minutes. Can you tell us some of the real tough injustices that you face at work? And Tell us how it was, your experience. Mr. Carlos Birrell, are you mute, on mute? Can you hear me?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Thanks. Can you hear me now?
Loud and clear.
Okay, so I can tell you I have identified serious situation of fundamental problems in the system, whereby from the very first moment you go to Ministry of Labor, you encounter thousands of people trying and seeking for a better way of life. So right there, it's a competition to get in to get something, to get a contract. And they'll tell you there that, oh, you're getting this opportunity, don't mess it up. That's what they say to you. And that in itself, it leaves you feeling like, you know, you don't have any self-worth, and you're supposed to do whatever it takes to hold on to this golden opportunity that you're given. That's the package they put it in. You're given a golden opportunity, and the onus is for you to do whatever it takes to keep it. Now, when you are landed in Canada, it continue, the abuse continue, whereby your employer try to break in your psyche that, look, you have no worth. We own you. You do what we tell you to do regardless, or we can just send you back home. And because of that, you have a lot of migrant workers following these dangerous instructions only because in the back of their mind, they had their family to feed. And this is the golden opportunity that was presented to them. And all they have to do at this point is to be obedient and follow the leader. You know that song? Follow the leader, leader, leader. Follow the leader. And it is serious and it is sad. And because of that, right now, we have a lot of migrant workers who have lost their lives because of this. And immigration further strengthens this act by putting on the work permit that these workers aren't allowed to study. Isn't education a part of your basic human right? The right to learn, the right to improve? Why is that there? You know? So, you know, when you look at the situation, you realize that it is much deeper than what it seems to be on the surface. It's all about exploiting. It's all about, might as well you call it human trafficking. Right? And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much, Carlos. Being a migrant farm worker, it's never, we are the receiving end. We are the wrong end of the stick. We receive a lot of injustices. I was counting, I think I stopped when I got to 20. But during this year, because we encourage to remain at home, you know, to stay at home, we people tend to reflect more on how secure is their how secure is their food supply. And when I look at the food chain in Canada, from the seed all the way to your table, to your plate, when I look at that, who are the people doing that work? Who are the people that are planting your food? Who are the people that are packaging your food? Who are the people that are picking it? Who are the people that are preparing it? Who are the people that are processing it? Who are the people that are taking care of the plants? Who are the people that are doing the distribution? Who are those people? Who are those people? According to the laws of Canada, a migrant worker by definition, you know, and that's enshrined in Canadian law. These are people who cannot vote. They are denied the right to vote. Imagine a vote being denied the right to vote means you don't have a voice. That is why tonight is so important, because 40,000 to 60,000 workers, migrant workers in Canada, we cannot vote. So who would listen to us? We cannot vote. That is why tonight is important. Can you imagine, by definition, you know, enshrining Canadian law, a migrant worker is somebody who's denied the right to participate in culture and community. Denied the right to participate in culture and community. Where's that? In a country, you know, in a country that prides itself as a champion for human rights, you know. Does that make us a human or less of a human? To be a migrant worker in Canada, enshrining Canadian law, we denied the right to participate in family life. Your best days in Canada, a migrant worker's worst days in Canada. a migrant worker, they've enshrined in Canadian law, we are denied the right to be protected by ordinary labor standards. Ordinary labor standards. Enshrined in Canadian law. You know? We are denied the right to access adequate and comprehensive healthcare. And the list goes on, and I'll go to the bottom. We are denied the right to unionize. Can you imagine the working conditions associated with non-unionized work? Can you imagine the working conditions? Non-unionized work. So in a nutshell, being a migrant worker in Canada, what does that mean? We are denied equality. To be a migrant worker in Canada, we are denied equality. To be a migrant worker in Canada, we are denied basic labor rights. We are denied basic human rights. Isn't that the recipe? And on top of it, we are tied to our employer. We are denied basic labor rights, basic human rights, and we are tied to employer. Isn't that the recipe for exploitation? Let us talk a little about that. I will start with Dr. Evelyn. During this year, during this pandemic, it has exposed what we've tried, what it has taken you 20 years to talk about and highlight. It has just taken a couple of months, the pandemic, to expose it. According to somebody, and that's a common say now, COVID-19 has exposed Canada's dirty secret. Can you tell us some of the things that you've seen in your area, Dr. Evelyn, during the pandemic, please?
Ooh, I have many thoughts, but I will be as strategic as possible for our time. First, I want to say that for me, this pandemic, I really thought that we were going to arrive and be at this historical moment where our dream and the demand for status was going to be more of a reality and was going to be closer, you know, within our grips. But then I saw how the lobbying power of farmers, you know, that wins again. That government again, you know, throws money at employers, trusting employers blindly, but not so blindly, because basically the government cares more about employers than they do about migrant workers' lives and migrant workers and their families. So I saw that this hierarchy of peoples, you know, was entrenched further by the Canadian government. And, you know, it shouldn't be a shock to us because, you know, we have to just think about how Canada was founded to begin with. As a settler colonial racist state, right? You know, just 2 weeks ago, the Canadian government sent out a release saying that they were going to expand the seasonal agricultural workers program for primary agriculture, making it easier for employers to hire migrant workers for this purpose. So instead of responding to our calls for status, they basically reward employers further without, you know, addressing any of our concerns around freedom. So I've seen also, you know, good out of this, good in terms of communities coming together, how, you know, folks in Leamington, the labor community in Leamington, the work of, you know, also Justicia through mostly the work of Elizabeth Ha, Vasanti, a professor at University of Windsor, who also is from that area. I've seen them coming together and mobilizing more students and people already in the region, because a lot of us, you know, during this time, we haven't been able to go out to the farms if we are not from the community. So, but we already have people too in many of the communities that could indeed go out. And then, of course, the work that has been done through food share, getting food boxes to migrant workers. I've seen people coming together and I've seen more folks learn about migrant workers, but quite frankly, I've been doing this work with, you know, other Justicia long timers for 20 years, and I'm tired of doing raising awareness. I'm tired because it's almost like it's an endless task. And what is really happening here is segregation and alienation from each other. And, you know, and it's also us basically always being set up against these powerful lobbying groups in agriculture. They're the ones that have the most power. They're the ones that eclipse everything. And so when it comes to change you know, it's really dirty, and those who have the most force, either through violence or money, are the ones who win. But recently there has also been a victory for the Trinidadian workers, thanks to the work of other Justicia organizers that have been really loud about Trinidadian workers from, well, Trinidad and Tobago, who have been stuck here. Their government didn't want them back, their country didn't want them back because of public health concerns. And then they were caught like in this limbo where basically they were unwanted, you know, unwanted as Canadian citizens, as unwanted here as workers, unwanted in their home countries. But the government turned around and said that, you know, that they would facilitate the process of the open work permit so that way they could also access EI, because workers pay into EI. And over the years, if we could do the calculations of how much money migrant farm workers are put into the Canadian system, it's in the millions and millions of dollars. So, you know, we have seen that when the government wants to do something, that they will. So basically, it's been, you know, a mix throughout this time. But for me personally, I feel disappointed that, you know, I'm just wondering, did we lose that moment for status? And we also can't forget that we lost already 3 migrant workers from our communities who died because of COVID-19, 3 Mexican workers. So there has been a lot of loss and lots of lessons. But, you know, today, that's, you know, primarily the message that I want to leave with you about this moment for status. We have to get it back and we have to keep on pressuring for that. Let's not give up.
Thank you so much. As moderator, I try to slow down the time, but that's the fastest hour I've ever seen. I don't know what to do to slow down the time. So to you, the viewers and participants, please feel free to, put in your question in the chat. We will go a little over. We're hoping to take questions from 10 minutes for questions, 7 to 7:10. So feel free to put in your questions because time is moving so fast. I try to slow down the hands of time, but yet still it's moving fast. Mr. Asav, can you tell us what you've seen as a result of, COVID in the area where you are, please?
Sure. I'll just focus on maybe a couple of really short things that I think a lot of points have already been well covered and there's no need to repeat. A lot of the same things are happening, but in particular in Nova Scotia, this one example that hasn't been brought up yet is farmers denying migrant farm workers the ability to leave the farm, basically imprisoning them on the farm. That's what's been going on. This came to the media in the summer. What was basically happening was farmers were using the veil of COVID-19 to suggest that migrant farm workers were not supposed to leave the farm. And of course, under that kind of pressure with an employer who has that level of control and holds your status in their pocket and can blacklist you and all that, it's more than just saying you can't leave. It's like physically making it impossible to leave. And what happened from that, yes, it made the news, but there's absolutely no indication at all that anything actually happened in response to do anything about the situation. But meanwhile, at the same time, non-migrant farm workers, so other workers on the farm who were not migrant workers, were able to leave. So it had nothing to do with quarantine. This wasn't about quarantine. This was past the quarantine time. This was simply when things were supposed to be okay to go to the grocery store, go wherever in the town, were denied. So that's one thing, and that's definitely the employer using the opportunity of COVID-19 to restrict migrant farm workers from their rights. This is clearly a human rights violation, but it happened, and it's something that needs to be addressed, and it's something that is being looked at for the next season to try to put a stop to. So I guess just in the interest of time, I'll focus on that. I'm sure a lot of the other issues will be brought up by others here.
Yeah, thank you so much. I just need to point out a couple of things. Imagine during this year, the government of Jamaica had the workers, the migrant farm workers from Jamaica, to sign a waiver, basically telling the workers, you at your own risk, go at your own risk. So basically freeing the government of any potential health troubles or whatever risk that they may face, that the government is free of that. And that is the government of Jamaica. And I used to think a couple of years gone by, I used to think that if something is legal, that it was just. I used to think so. But look at that. Who are the politicians loyal to? Who are they loyal to? You, the voter? me, the worker, or their donors. And that is what the program is. The program is surely the politicians, and the program is surely bent towards their donors. And as you've heard, Dr. Evelyn said, that the agricultural sector, they are lobbyists, right? And so they lobby the government, and they're also major donors. And that is where the policy is bent, the program is bent towards. Also during this year, and at this point in time, which is a major challenge that we're facing, that we have something that we've never experienced before, where Trinidadian migrant farm workers are caught stranded in Canada, and that's a major challenge. And it's also highlighted, you know, there's so many myths, right? The employers would say, and the farmers would say, oh, I treat my workers like family. Isn't that a common myth? I treat them like family. What is that? Hey, here is a classic example, how workers have been treated like family. Hey, it's a classic example. In St. Lucia, imagine during this week in St. Lucia, in my home country, the government said it is estimated this year that roughly 250 migrant farm workers came to Canada this year. It is estimated 5 of them run away after completing the program. They move away from the program. As a result of that, the government in my country is asking, is thinking or considering, or they're pushing for potential workers or other workers to put a deposit that basically tying them to coming back. Now, all of this are showing in my country that is used to show, to pin the workers, migrant farm workers, as they being bad. Imagine five workers moving away from the program, they'll be labeled as they being bad. And they never, the politicians again, they do not highlight the injustices. According to a song, only a fool breaks his own heart, right? Only a fool does that. Would you run away from something that's good? They wouldn't highlight it like that. But they would highlight it as the workers are being bad. But because of time, I have a few questions there. In the interest of time, let me see if I can go to the questions here. Question number one. Somebody's asking, can anybody talk about being denied the right to participate in culture and family life? Okay, I can take a little of that and feel free to add to it because of time. Basically, in Canada, being a migrant farm worker, you deny the right to have status. And not having status means you deny basic human rights. And what is one of the basic human rights? That you're not allowed to bring your family. You can only bring your family, be with your family, if you have status in Canada. And that is what not having status is. That is the war that every migrant worker face. Regardless where you go, migrant workers face that war. We fight those two wars. On one hand, we fight for better conditions, better working conditions, better living conditions, better working conditions. And on the other hand, we keep worrying about our families back home. Imagine being disconnected from your family for so many months in a year. The bright moments in your family, the challenges in your family, you're missing out on that. And that is what Canada have been using. And that is what, in the Caribbean, it is commonly called, referred to as the barrel baby, where we are separated from our families. Our families go to the greener pastures, and they would send a barrel for us. What do I mean by a barrel? A box of goodies. So they call us barrel babies because we see the gifts and they do not see our presence. So can you imagine the amount of damage that's been done to our family just by physical separation? Can you imagine the amount of damage that's been done to the basic unit of society, basic unit of society, which is our family? To make it worse, in a couple of years, maybe in 2003, thereabout, it was possible for migrant workers to access EI, the parental leave benefit, that you could spend some time to bond with your family. Under the conservative government, they took that off. Can you imagine what's happening? That you cannot bond with your own family. Can you imagine the danger that's happening to our society as a result of that, the absenteeism that the program is causing? I don't know if anybody would like to add to that. My eyes is fixed on the time. Let me see if the other question, would you like?
I think Carlos Burrell wants to say something.
Yeah, please.
Okay, what they do is separate and apart from making it difficult to access, participate Kingin culture in this country, and also keep in contact with your family. What they do to bury you is put you to work 7 days a week. You work holidays, you work 16 hours, 12 hour shift. Where is the time to even get a proper sleep, much less to converse with your family? And that is the fundamental tool that they use to enslave us. And I can tell you, from being on both sides of the coin, what I'm experiencing now during COVID caused you to be lonely, caused you to be sad, caused you to be all this. But at the same time, you have access to the internet, you have access to television, you have access to do whatever you want to do. But put yourself in the migrant worker's shoes. You're in one 10 by 10 room with 6 bunk beds, and each bunk bed is separated by a curtain, and all the space you have is the size of the bed, right? And you're there in that, after you come from work, you're there isolated. The only break they used to get when I was there is on a weekend. You look forward to going to a party to meet the opposite sex and to socialize. And you know, you get your mind off of the stress and everything you're going through, but now all that is gone. So what's happening to these migrant workers psychologically? You know, so that is one of the big questions we have to ask when we are going through our own personal discomfort because of this pandemic. Think about what they're going through, you know, and basically that's what I want to say right now.
Oh, thank you so much, Carlos. Other things, though, but the fact, in addition to what you just said, we work literally Sunday to Sunday, And that was my experience in my first 2 years until they gave us the Sunday off. That's one. We work literally every day. That's one. Number two, we work long hours. So where's the time for you to participate? We work long hours. Number three, we live on the farms. We are property of farmers. We are not integrated into society. Another powerful question I have there is, I would like other panelists to add to it, is the question is, would you liken migrant labor in Canada to a continuation of indentured labor practices in the Caribbean? I would like to start off that conversation by telling you the participants, it is presented to you as buy local. And buy local is such a nice one. Look at the bag. It's a dazzling bag, you know. Buy local. You think of freshness. You think of good health. You think of supporting the local economy. But tonight, I want to open that bag, that buy local bag. And what is it? Canada is telling the sending countries, send me people who are black, people who are brown, people of color. That's what Canada is saying. People of color. Where are people of color coming from? Europe or the global south? The global south. That is why that program came in place in the first place. So Canada is saying, send me people of color. Canada is saying, I prefer if these people of color, English is a second language to them, or if they are illiterate. The third thing Canada wants, people of color, language is a problem. And the third thing, if these people are ignorant about labor issues and human rights issues. These are the three things Canada is looking for. People of color from the global south. Language is a problem, so I can play with these people. And they're ignorant. They don't know anything about human rights issues and labor issues. Now, what happened now? That is the fruits and the vegetables that you buy local. That is what's behind it. What happens when we get to Canada? Canada welcomes us in a climate of fear. And that is clearly highlighted in Migrant Dreams and El Contrato, climate of fear. There's so much power in the hands of our employer. And as I've said, our status is in the pocket of our employer. So they welcome us in a climate of fear. There's fear built in that program, right through that program. We can talk a whole night about how fear is built in it. And where is that happening? It's happening, is it south of the border? It's happening right here in a country. Canada is known as a country with a culture of silence. Nobody says nothing. We are isolated, we are made invisible, and the Canadian culture, they say nothing. And what is happening? Is that an illegal program? That has a full blessing of government. That has a full blessing of God. And that is what the program is. And that is, it is people of color who have been exploited. So yes, as I said a while ago, depending on where I am, I am a God. Depending on where I am an angel. Depending on where I am a slave. Depending on where I'm a half human. Depending on where I'm a lab rat. And that is what the program is. It's a continuation of indentured labor that we saw in the Caribbean. That and most of the workers, that is where they've been drawn. Who on the panelists would like to add to the conversation, to the discussion here? Because time is really tight.
I guess I can add a very quick point is that it's very clearly the idea of being tied to an employer. That's precisely what indentured servitude is all about. And in addition, that it just continues, despite all of the demands that have been made year after year for permanent resident status and the necessity of that in order for anybody to be treated as a human being. Temporary nature and tied to an employer is exactly what allows for the exploitation, but it's exactly what the farmers want, because they want the most vulnerable workforce possible. And of course, as is already mentioned by Gabriel, it's targeting specific people, starting specifically Black, Brown, people of color in the Global South. So it is definitely no question in my mind that it's indentured servitude.
Thank you so much. I just read in the chat that that the contracts that we sign in Canada, it's similar to the contracts that indentured workers sign coming to the Caribbean. So it's very, so basically it's the same thing. And these contracts are employer driven, right? Let me see, is there any other question? I'm not seeing any other question, but because of time, in closing, I would like to make a quick round. In closing, what would you like to see? How would you, tonight, I don't know how you do that virtually, how do you push the audience to the next round to take action? Quickly, in maybe a minute or two, how can you push your audience? Can we make a quick round? Asaf, since you're here, can you push the audience to take action in the next hour, please?
Absolutely. I mean, now, I think it was already mentioned before by Evelyn that the importance right now of really pushing for status for all and really pushing when finally, as Zara also mentioned, Canada's dirty little secret has been fully exposed, that now is really the time to push and push as hard as possible to make sure that their justice is done. You know, it's, all these issues have been spoken about over and over again, and now's the time. Now is the time to do something more than ever before.
Thank you so much, Carlos.
I just want to say really quickly that I think what we need to remember here is that Canada has in place a system that infringes upon human rights without actually violating its laws. And that's the important thing, because it allows employers to violate labor rights without violating the laws. And that's why, what does that tell us? That tells us that we need to change those laws. That's what we need to do. You know, we need to change those laws that allow for human rights violations to be legal. And I think that we should remember that. Yeah.
Thank you so much. The next, Carlos, what would you tell the audience to push them to take action, Carlos? Carlos.
I want to encourage them to, you know, the only solution I see to this problem is status on arrival. Because once you have status, then it's an equal playing field and you come under Ministry of Labor Protection and stuff, and the government can't give a blind eye to you at that point. So in my mind, that's the solution, right? And we need to push for that, because these farm workers are human beings just like you and I. And every feeling, every emotion that we experience, they experience it too. And sometimes at a greater volume, right? And we need to understand that even now in the winter, they are working under inhumane circumstance, even though the pandemic is there. If they catch a simple flu, they have to go home and quarantine for 2 weeks. That's a loss of income that they didn't even have enough money in the first place. So we need to fight so that people can remain strong, remain healthy, and their family can grow to be who they were meant to be, to contribute in a future society the way they were meant to contribute. And I'm getting so emotional, so I leave it there.
Positive. Thank you, Dr. Evelyn. How can you push the audience to take action, please? And thank you.
Yes, I was just, feeling into my heart rather than being in my head with what I was going to say. And, you know, I just got all of these images of, you know, all the families I've met along the years, all of these stories that so many people in Canada don't know about. But now you know. Now you know about the situation of migrant workers. And now it's your turn. We laid the foundation. We gave most of our youth to this movement. Now it's your turn to use your voice, use your power, and you all do have power. So we hand it over to you to shake things up. We've done our part. Now it's your turn. So please take everything that you can within you, spread the word, tell your friends and family, discuss it, send a note to your MP, your MPP, just spread the word that we want status upon arrival to end this situation and system of exploitation that has gone on far too long. And us in Justicia, we only want to work with people who also want to call for status, because without that call, it's a betrayal to migrant workers and their families. So it's not just about migrant workers, it's about their entire communities that depend on migration, that suffer from prolonged absences. And this year in particular has been so hard because migrant workers had to make that choice, either staying home or potentially starving, or coming to Canada, potentially getting sick and never returning, and perhaps returning in a body bag. So, you know, we need to press for a world where we all have dignity, where we all have choice, where we all could survive, right, and live with decent livelihoods. This is being denied to migrant workers, and it's been far too long. So I hand it over to you. We hand it over to you.
Thank you. Beautiful. I like that. To you, the audience, are you concerned how your food is being produced, whether it's been grown by people who respect the soil, respect the environment, and respect the workers, or you don't care whether they exploit the soil, exploit the environment, exploit the workers? Every time I see a leaf, I want to see a leaf that is green. Every time I see the Canadian flag, I see a red leaf. In my country, red means danger, and it reminds me of those 20 injustices that we face in the production of your food. We all know that the food has been synthesized in leaves, but not in a red, dangerous leaf. And that is the society that we have. Don't you have the power in your hands? And that is what we, in Canada, only our hands are needed in Canada. But I want you tonight to focus on your hands. There's power in your hands as a consumer. There's power in your hands as a voter. There's power in your hands as a student, as a human being. There's power in your hands. Tonight, I want you to discover that power and to use it to take action. And in closing, I want to tell you that we're asking for status. What does status do? Status will do many things. The 20 injustices that we face, it will take, status is our Tylenol. Status is our Panadol. Status is our Advil. It will take care of most of the headaches. And one of the biggest headaches it will take care of, it will help us to have an open work permit. If I have status, I would have an open work permit. That would put the pressure on my employer to create the conditions to attract me and to keep me, right? And that is important. But without status, I am tied to my employer and my employer's mercy. Is that fair? Is that the world that we want? So there's power in your hand. So right now, I'm going to push you virtually to take action to the next session. I would like to thank each and everyone for participating, for your attention. I hope I've given you a million reasons to take action. And to you, the panelists who helped me to give them over a million reasons, thank you so much.